This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Atul Gawande, author of three best-selling books, The Checklist Manifesto, Better, and Complications. He is also a general surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and a professor at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health. His awards include a MacArthur Fellowship, the Lewis Thomas Prize, and two National Magazine Awards, among others. Atul Gawande is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End, published in 2014. Welcome.
Thank you.
What was your reason for writing Being Mortal?
Well, it's about the ways we handle mortality in medicine and outside of medicine. And the reasons why were that, you know, I'm about a decade now into my practice as a surgeon. And along the way, I felt like I didn't have very good answers for how to deal with the reality of mortality. I didn't learn much about mortality in medical school. I went into surgery to save people. And yet I was finding half of my patients were coming to me with problems I could not fix. And when those were mortal problems, they often suffered severely at the end. And then add to it that my dad, a surgeon himself, was diagnosed with a cancer in his brainstem and spinal cord. It was going to grow very slowly. We knew that, and we knew it was not curable. And trying to navigate these questions better than we had before, but better than I saw in my own patients, was part of the reason as well.
In your book, you speak about the fact that we just fall apart as we age. Would you explain?
So one of the things we don't learn about in medical school, so what's the science of what happens to the body as we age, develop chronic illness than a final pathway? And one of the things is that, you know, there's this theory that, well, maybe it's genetic, you know, like bamboo, the way bamboo grows, you can have stands of bamboo that live for 100 years, then suddenly one day flower and just die all at once, all of them kind of pre-programmed to work that way. And so the thought has been that, well, maybe that's the way human beings are, that we're kind of pre-programmed. You know, the contrary school of thinking is the wear and tear school. You just kind of wear down. And more, I think the evidence is that we're not really in the genetic school. Genetics can matter. But if you take identical twins, for example, when it comes to height, 90% of how tall you are is based on genetics. And identical twins will be very close to the same height. But they will die on average 15 years apart. Quite different spans are possible.
How is the experience of being an elder different now than in the past?
Pretty fundamentally different. First of all, being an elder was a rare kind of thing. It was less than 3-4% of the population who would live past 70 years old. The average person in the 19th century lived to the late 40s. You know, go back millennia and age 30 was the median life expectancy. And today, we're closing in on 20% of the population who are elderly. Now, what makes that different is, I mean, there's all kinds of fascinating things. For example, one thing is the way people lie about their age. So in a former time, say in the 1700s and 1800s, people who had censuses would have to adjust for the fact that people lie, and they had to adjust because people lied in the direction of claiming to be older than they were. You know, that was the era where people would wear powdered gray wigs to look older and more wise. And today, we've been now for a century lying in the direction of claiming to be younger than we are. There's a sense that being older is feared, and we have great concern about what happens to us as we get older, even though we both live longer and live better than we have ever in history.
In what ways has modern medicine fallen short in dealing with the elderly?
Well, so many ways. I think that in the course of this book, I ended up interviewing more than 200 patients, many of them mine, and then also family members about their experiences with aging and with dying, or at least facing serious illness. Interviewed people who were also ones who are very likely to see these kinds of folks, so hospice workers, palliative care doctors, geriatricians. And, you know, I think the pattern is that, number one, our fundamental failing is that we fail to realize that people have priorities besides just living longer. People really care deeply about not just being a kind of pulsing organism that's alive, but we have reasons to be alive. And the second thing is that the most effective way to find out what people's priorities are besides just living longer is to ask them. And we don't ask them in medicine. We don't ask people. And as a result, we have this very narrow value that safety and survival is all that we're trying to make sure is possible for people.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but what are the drawbacks of treating aging as a medical concern?
I think the main thing that we miss out on is the idea of what a good life might be for different people. You know, the whole aim and value of health, of doing what I do, should be about making possible the kind of life people want to live and not just a quantity of existence. And we seem not to be willing to do that. When you don't do that, you see everything from the suffering of people who go into surgery with me, go to the operating room, thinking they're getting the lottery tickets chance, you know, get that chance that I will kick this thing, where I know they're most likely, very unlikely to, and then they never wake up. They never got their chance to say goodbye. They never even knew they were leaving this world and had some chance to think about what they wanted with that time. We also don't attend to people suffering terribly effectively. We don't think about the fact that there may be some life that is really worth living, even under constrained circumstances, even if it is a very short time. And I tell lots of stories from my daughter's piano teacher, who was in the hospital for weeks, just dying in pain, who wanted nothing more than a chance to just teach her students a little bit longer. And going on hospice, it gave her that opportunity that she didn't even know was possible. And other stories like that, that start to pull apart, you know, what do we want in these moments? How different is it from person to person? How does that change as we face the circumstances we do? I think these are really important questions that have been largely hidden.
Geriatrics is an attempt to deal with medical needs of the elderly. How is the approach of geriatrics different from usual medical approaches?
Well, this is really interesting. Number one, it's this field that takes for granted that there may be things that are going to be things that we're not going to be able to fix in medicine. And for those problems, they want to protect the quality of the time you have. And so geriatricians will take seriously the idea, for example, that falls might be the most important danger you face to the kind of life you want to live. And it may be more important than your high blood pressure or than whether you get a colonoscopy. And those skills are actually not taught in medical school. 97% of medical schools don't teach basic geriatric skills. And the result is, both from our medical school training and residency training, we don't realize there are four major risk factors for the likelihood that after age 75, that you're going to fall and break your hip. And it's not just whether you have bone density tests that suggest a problem. It's being on medications that might cause dizziness. It's your nutrition. It's your strength when you get up from a chair and whether you can stand up just on your own or not. And that there are, on top of that, known things we can do to make it possible for people to not fall and therefore be independent longer. And that we're not teaching?
Why is the approach of geriatrics not supported more?
There's so many different reasons. I talk to one geriatrician, they say, well, no one wants to deal with the old croc. That's part of the problem. You know, the old croc has 5 different medical problems, 10 different medications, and 6 specialists, and none of their problems are ones that you can make go away with an operation or let me give you this pill. They're hard of hearing, and it takes twice as long in the appointment than you want them to, and they ain't getting out of your office in less than 40 minutes. Now, the fact that you can do good for people and add life to the time that they have is undervalued to the point that they're among our lowest paid members of our profession. And that, you know, I do very well coming up with procedures I can do for people. I'm a surgeon. But the sense that I might be able to have a set of skills, I didn't even understand what the skills were of geriatricians. You know, the geriatrics clinic in my hospital was the floor below my surgery office. And in 10 years, I'd never wandered inside. And getting to be a writer let me say, you know, hey, I'm writing this book. Could I just come watch you do your work? And just even like the skill with which they examine the feet for whether you're at risk of falls and what can be done to make it so you're able to manage well. We haven't valued those because we don't pay for the time we take in these visits very well. And also because no one, you know, is shouting for the lack of enough geriatricians in the world. You know, we fear you're going to take away the device that we might put into your body, but not your geriatrician.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Atul Gawande, author of the book Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Nursing homes are a common place to go when people become too frail to take care of themselves. How did nursing homes come about?
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting is that I thought as I dug into the history of nursing homes, it'd be the story of, wow, we've added 30 years to people's life over the last century. And so, you know, we've made it so that you can have a good quality of life, but we have to deal with now people in their 80s who might have some loss of memory and cognitive issues or just becoming too frail to take care of themselves. We were making these as special places for people to have this phase of your life. And that wasn't the case at all, it turned out. We built them starting in the 50s and then going into the 60s because the hospitals were getting full of old people and they wanted to get rid of them. And so we created these homes as places where they might be nursed back to health. That's why we called them nursing homes. We weren't even admitting that these might be, are likely to be, their final way station. They were places that were valued entirely around making them safe, making sure they protect health, but never thinking about what is the purpose that people have in their lives. We have this missing idea that just because I'm in a wheelchair and I'm a little slower than I used to be, that therefore, you know, somebody else has to take over and be the boss of your life. And that's part of what makes it so miserable for people to be in these environments.
What is the history of assisted living facilities? Why were they started?
Yeah, so it was in rebellion against this whole phenomenon. There's a woman, a fascinating woman, Karen Brown Wilson, who was in Portland, Oregon, when she helped build with her husband the first assisted living facility. And it was because when she was 19, her mother had a stroke. Her mother was 55. She was severely disabled after the stroke, some difficulty with slurred speech, paralyzed on the side of her body, needed 24-hour care. And because she needed 24-hour care, the assumption is that she would live in a place that you're told when you wake up, you have a pill line every day, you have to take a shower when they tell you, eat when they tell you. And, you know, what she wanted, as she explained to her daughter, she's like, help me make a home, a place where I can have a lock on my door, where I have privacy, where I can have my stack of National Geographic magazines without someone coming through and throwing them all away. Might even be able to be allowed to have a pet. And so Karen Wilson created, it was just about 2 decades ago, the first assisted living facility to genuinely assist people with living. Over time, they were made to be more and more like nursing homes. It was intended to be something that might abolish the nursing home, might replace the nursing home. It ended up being, in some places, exactly that. In most places, it has become folded into our very narrowed idea instead.
Would you expand on the ways in which assisted living and nursing homes fall short for the elderly?
Here's the best way to put it. You know, Karen Wilson said to me, their priority goal is safety because they are looking at it from the point of view of what the adult children want for their parents instead of what the parents actually want. She said, safety is what we want for those we love and autonomy is what we want for ourselves. And these places, when they go in, it's often the adult child who's the decision maker. They'll go in with the parent will defer, and all the questions are around, you know, how safe is it here? But very little about how lonely are people here? How bored are they here? How much are they able to connect to their friends, the church that they used to go to, the things that make life worth living? You know, I talked to a woman who had been a librarian all her life and could have been someone who was tapped into for being able to teach, to curate, to manage what was there. But just because she now needed help through the day, that was taken away. You know, it gets worse. For example, there are battles over food. I visited a place that built alternative ways. There's a group of people call themselves the nursing home abolitionists, and they've built these places that, for example, are built instead of around a nurse's station. You know, nursing homes look more and more like hospitals. This was a dozen rooms, private rooms, that's revolution, built around a kitchen. And in the kitchen, you can go in the refrigerator and you could get whatever you want from the refrigerator whenever you wanted. That's like revolution. It's incredibly controversial because suppose people go to the refrigerator and take out stuff that's not good for them. You know, they might go get a soda if they're diabetic. And that's where the conflict arises. Will you have the freedom to have your own fridge that you could go to whenever you want?
So what have been some of the more promising efforts to improve nursing homes and or assisted living for elders? What are the best approaches to make life worth living when someone can't fend for themselves?
Well, I thought there was going to be one formula, but I ended up visiting lots of places that had many different patterns. You know, I saw a place that allowed everybody to own their own pets. They had dogs and birds and cats. Another place called the greenhouses was that design I just described, with being built around a kitchen, and people are allowed to wake up whenever they want, and they have their own private rooms, and they can follow along with caregivers who are helping them to understand what would be just a good day to you and make it possible. I visited a senior living facility for low-income elderly in Reading, Mass., in northern Massachusetts. And what's fascinating is, even in a place that they didn't have much money, it was not that hard. Well, it's hard. Every day it's hard, but it was more money. And I saw an Alzheimer's patient. She was in a wheelchair. She thought she was 55 years old. In fact, she was in her 80s. She had forgotten her last couple of husbands. But you could see the desire she had. She loved being with people. She loved going out. And they would arrange for her to be able to go out to TGI Fridays, was her favorite place to go. And she'd have a margarita, and they'd triple up on the Depends. And she'd have joy, and she'd have things she loved. And it was allowed for her to make, you know, as the person running the place said, Ruth was allowed to make bad choices just like the rest of us sometimes.
You are attuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Atul Gawande, author of the book Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. How has modern medicine changed the experience of death?
Well, I think the biggest change is we've institutionalized it. So in 1945, the majority of Americans died in their home. And, you know, we did because we didn't think if we were seriously ill, the hospital was going to have much to offer, and we were probably not wrong at that time. And then we had half a century of incredible discovery where we could do a lot of things for people, but we couldn't cure dying. And so when we came to death, by the end of the 90s, 83% of the population died in institutions, with only 17% in the home. And the ways that things had changed was that we have always thought that, well, when medicine has nothing to offer, I will know what to do. But we're in a position now in medicine where we always have something more that can offer. We can always put you on another machine, always give you another round of therapy, always do X, Y, and Z. And we have not been good in walking through our ways to just ask some basic questions. You know, what is your understanding of your health and your condition? What are the fears and worries that you might have for the future? What are your goals? What are the outcomes that are unacceptable to you? And then using that to guide the plan and care that we offer. We've been afraid to ask those questions.
What's been standing in the way of having those hard conversations toward the end of life?
There's so many things. There's fear on all sides. There's the fear of the doctor heading into very emotional territory. Someone might cry in your office, and you feel like that's failure when you're a doctor. I think we also feel like, look, if I can't fix the problem, I don't know how to be competent. And so that's our end of the scale. Patients fear, every one of us fears having to discuss these things in many ways. Family can fear it as well. You're not paid to take the time for these conversations. That pushes in the other direction. So it all kind of lines up pushing in that direction. And yet, the killer is, and I mean that literally, trials show that when you have these conversations, people end up choosing to stop aggressive therapy sooner, like chemotherapy, for example, that they will spend less time in the hospital, much less likely to die in the ICU, spend longer on hospice, and live equally long, and in many trials, longer. For example, in lung cancer, 25% longer when these conversations are had and people choose less aggressive therapy when their health begins to worsen. That is a sign of how much we failed, how the fear and lack of skill in being able to have these kinds of conversations, the fact that we haven't made them normal to do, ends up costing people suffering and even length of life.
Would you say more about how we can decide when to shift from pushing against limits to making the best of them?
You know, there's no set point. You go from being willing to sacrifice your time and quality of life now for the sake of possible time in the future to wanting to be in a place where you start to think about, how do I make sure we're using even medical technology to give you the best possible time now, regardless of the consequences for the length. And the signs are usually that, you know, when you have a really serious illness, you will go through very aggressive first round of therapy. And when that doesn't work, you might go to a second avenue. But at a certain point, here's a question that we asked doctors, the people I saw who are good at this, asked doctors to answer, which is, would you be surprised if this person would die in the next 6 months? And if you wouldn't be surprised, it doesn't mean that you make the transition necessarily, but you do ask the questions. And people of their own accord, when they start seeing that their daily priorities are being sacrificed for the chance of a lottery ticket that your number may not win, then people start to become the drivers of how far you want to go towards giving up on the things you care about today. And different people will choose in different ways. But unless you have that conversation, no one ever gets off the train. The doctor is always there to just say, well, what about this one thing more?
How successful has hospice care been for people at the end of life?
Well, I think some of that data about how palliative care and starting hospice care sooner indicates it's been remarkably effective. Our main hurdle is that we come to hospice too late and too infrequently, you know, with only a day or two left. You know, I mentioned we'd gone to the point where more than 80% of us die in institutions by the end of the 90s. That is just starting to change in a remarkable way. The last 5 years, it has crossed 45% of the population now die in hospice care, about half in their own home and half in hospice centers outside of hospitals and nursing homes that don't provide those services. And that is a setting where family or friends enter back into the picture. It is a way that people start to have this experience with this being part of our natural phases of life. And that experience is starting to return to becoming a part of the mainstream of life.
What are the key steps we need to take as a society to better address caring for the elderly and help people achieve what's most important to them at the end of their lives?
I think the key things are that when you're worried about what's happening to your family member, it might be your spouse, your child, your parents, your grandparents, that it's okay to ask questions about it. And those questions go back to those really simple ones that are so powerful, you know. So tell me, what is your understanding of your health? You know, what are your fears and worries? Now, some people aren't ready to answer those questions, and trying to jam it down anybody's throat is not a great thing. But it is something that unfolds over time, and we all avoid it until crisis, doctors and families alike. But by then, it's too late. The real danger is that nowadays, because we can extend the life of the dying, 70% of us will come to the end of our lives with somebody else needing to make the decisions about when treatment should shift to trying to help make you have the best possibility now instead of sacrificing time for later. And if you haven't had these conversations as the path changes along the way, that's a real problem. I call it the ODTAA syndrome, that when people have reached the point of one damn thing after another, that's the point where, you know, we have to be willing to have those conversations. And if your doctors aren't initiating it, well, then we all can.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
First of all, I hope that when people read it, they just like the stories and like the writing and feel like they feel some understanding of our experience of being in the world. The second level is that I hope that it's lifting a curtain on the experiences people are having, both being a doctor trying to negotiate these kinds of difficult choices and being patients or family members. And there are a lot of different ways that it goes. I describe when it goes wrong as well, when families come into conflict. And I think just understanding that sometimes and seeing it, knowing what happens, is illuminating. And then I hope that it prompts us in medicine and families at any point to be willing to have that hard conversation and to know how to do it in ways that express concern instead of badgering about, hey, you're going to die. It's much more about, you know, tell me about your priorities, what you really care about in life, because time might be short. So what do we got to do?
Would you like to say a few words about your own current research on this topic?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I didn't write about it in the book. Thanks for bringing that up. So I'm both a researcher, writer, and surgeon. And what I love is the chance to discover problems that I see in surgery, write about them to help illuminate them. But then on the research side, try to figure out, you know, how can you do something about it? And so what we've done at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute is we enrolled, we got 80% of the clinicians to agree to enter a study where we trained half of them in a 2.5 hour training about how to have conversations the way a lot of these experts do. You know, the normal way we really teach people to talk to people with serious illnesses is to offer what I call the retail options. You know, you tell people option A, option B, option C, your chemotherapy, your treatment, or whatever, and here are the pros, the cons, the risks, the benefits, and then what do you want to do? And what people really want is counseling and guidance, and to be able to shift to being able to ask these kinds of questions. We've trained them in a 2.5 hour program. And then we are following the patients in both groups to see how well they do. And it's a cohort of now 400 patients that we're following all the way to death. And the puzzle is, you know, if palliative care experts can do this really well, can some simple training make it possible for an entire institution to change what happens at the end of life?
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
You know, the most significant message in my mind is just that we only have two simple failures. One is that we have not recognized that people have priorities besides just living longer, and that the most important thing we can do, it genuinely improves people's lives, is just to ask what their priorities are.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
And thank you.
You were just listening to Atul Gawande, author of the book Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End, published in 2014 by Metropolitan Books. For more information, check on the web at atulgawande.com. That's AtulGawande.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.